From the Southeast Asian capital city of the Philippine Islands, the Philippine nation, Manila. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Every single time zone around the earth covered by this, the largest program of its type in the world. It's called Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. It is indeed a pleasure to be with you on this a second day of the weekend. By the way, coming up next week, I have a three-day weekend, which for me means working 3 days. George will take a very well-earned day off, and I'll pull an extra day. And I've got, quite a few additional days coming toward the end of the month when we will do the yearly predictions that were locked in. In fact, actually left in the Bell family vault back in Nevada. Fortunately, I was able to, people are amazing. You know, people actually documented the list of predictions made, for this year and had them on the web. So, I just sort of rummaged around and found a list that somebody had made, a good, nice, accurate, written, typed out, in a much clearer version than my handwriting ever produced. So I have the list, and we will be making predictions, of course, at the end of the month for the coming year. It should be very, very interesting. Again, tonight, that little minx, Dolly, is, she's our new kitty cat. I guess it was inevitable. I'm a sucker for cats. You know me. Erin, by the way, is the exact same way. It was kind of a funny scene. When I first brought Yeti and Abby over here, they came out of their little transport cages, and Erin was scared to death of them, as most Filipinos, and rightfully so, are scared of cats, because here they scratch and they are kind of mean because they, you know, they're street cats and they get in fights and they just, you know, they just don't, they're very leery around human beings. Well, it took just a little while, and of course, as you well know, my cats, of course, are sweeties and don't bite and scratch and all that. And Erin fell in love with them, and she became as much of a cat person as I am, if not more. And then we met Dolly. I told the story last night. Every time we'd go to the restaurant over here, we'd run into this little minx of a cat that, unlike all the other street cats, would come up and rub on our legs and just do little twirls and twists and just be so cute. And so there was no way around it. We brought her once back to the condo, gave her a bath, welcomed her to the house, and then came to our senses and said, no, we can't do this. And so a couple of hours later, we took her back, put her right back in the very same area, and then 2 more weeks of walking past and meeting Dolly every day was too much. And so the other day, we brought her home for good. She went to the vet, got her shots, got tested, by the way, for those who are asking, got her shots, and she's well. And now she is the third cat in the condo, and she's just a darling, just a darling. Now, Abby loves her. They've been playing nonstop. In fact, you may hear them whizzing by. Yeti has not quite accepted her, although over the last couple of days it's been getting better, and he's hissing less. So now Dolly's proximity to Yeti, I would say when there's a foot or two only separating them, he will hiss. Prior to that, it didn't matter. She could be in the other room, and he was hissing. Oh, he was angry. He did not like the prospect of another cat around one bit. But he is slowly, it appears, adjusting. All right, let's take a look at the news, such as it is. While President Bush acknowledges the need for major changes in Iraq, he will not use this week's Iraq Study Group report, which is going to be kind of negative, I guess, as political cover for bringing the troops home. His national security advisor said Sunday, quote, "We have not failed in Iraq." Stephen Hadley said he made the talk show rounds and, quote, again, "We will fail in Iraq only if we pull our troops out before we're in a position to help the Iraqis succeed," end quote. And I do agree with that. And again, for those of you with no memory of it, I was very, very much against the Iraq War prior to our getting there. And after getting there, I feel that we have to find a way to honorably succeed, honorably extricate ourselves eventually, and hopefully leave some sort of better government than was there previously. President Hugo Chavez won re-election by not a little margin, but a wide margin Sunday, giving the firebrand leftists 6 more years to redistribute Venezuela's vast oil wealth to the poor and press his campaign to counter U.S. influence in Latin America and beyond. Challenger Manuel Rosales conceded defeat but vowed to remain in opposition. During the campaign, he accused Chavez of edging Venezuela towards authoritarian rule and warned the president could undertake even more radical policies should he be reelected. Speaking of elections, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton met on Sunday with New York's Democratic governor-elect to solicit his support for her now very likely White House bid. It was inevitable, wasn't it? The latest indication she's stepping up plans to join a growing field of potential contenders for 2008. Wow. It's getting cold back in mid-America. 4 die in Missouri as temperatures plunge. Frigid temperatures contributed to 4 deaths Sunday, pushing the toll from a devastating ice and snowstorm to 19 as hundreds of thousands waited yet another day for their electricity to be restored. I know the feeling. As temperatures rose into the 20s, Tawana Jean Cooper and her family sat at a Red Cross warming center in St. Louis, which they reached a day earlier from her suburban home after roads were finally cleared of ice, down power lines and broken tree limbs, by the way. The death toll, I am hearing now from credible sources here in the Philippines, from Typhoon Durian, is approaching 1,000, if not passing it already. It was truly an awful storm here. General Augusto Pinochet, whose 17-year dictatorship carried out thousands of political killings and widespread torture, was fighting for his own life in a Chilean hospital Sunday after suffering a heart attack. Doctors said, though, his condition is improving after an emergency procedure to restore blood flow to his heart. Doctors initially had said they planned bypass surgery on Sunday on the 91-year-old former strongman, but they later ruled it out, saying angioplasty apparently had done the job. The nightmares didn't start until months after Alicia Flores returned home. The images were stark. They were disturbing. In one dream, a dying Iraqi man desperately grabbed her arm. In another, she was lost in a blinding snowstorm. Make that sandstorm. They don't have snowstorms there. Sometimes Flores awakened to discover her mouth was dust dry, as if she were stumbling through the scorching 120-degree desert. Britain's senior law enforcement officials said Sunday an inquiry into the death of a former KGB agent has expanded overseas, and a U.S.-based friend of the former agent said he told police the name of the person he believes orchestrated the poisoning, said he had known the poisoned ex-spy Alexander Levitko since 2002, spoke with him on November 23rd, the day he died following his exposure to a very rare radioactive element, Polonium-210. And finally, more than 380 passengers and crew aboard the world's largest cruise ship were sickened by a virus during a 7-day Caribbean cruise. According to officials, the norovirus sickened 338 passengers and 46 crew members of the Royal Caribbean's Freedom of the Seas, and apparently they only needed to be treated with over-the-counter medication. In a moment, as Paul would say, we'll look at the rest of the news. Well, I told you I would mention this again. The apocalypse has a new date, 2048. That's when the world's oceans will be empty of fish. This is a prediction by an international team of ecologists and ecologists, thank you, and economists. The cause, the disappearance of species due to overfishing, pollution, habitat loss, and climate change. The study by Boris Warham, a PhD of a university in Halifax, Nova Scotia, with colleagues in the UK, US, Sweden, and Panama, was an effort to understand what this loss of ocean species might mean to the world. The researchers analyzed several different kinds of data. Even to those ecology-minded scientists, the results were an unpleasant surprise. Warham said, quote, "I was shocked and disturbed by how consistent these trends are beyond anything we had suspected. This isn't predicted to happen. This is happening now," according to Nicola Beaumont, PhD of the Plymouth, Maine Laboratory in UK. "If biodiversity continues to decline, the marine environment will not be able to sustain our way of life. Indeed, it may not be able to sustain our lives at all. Already 29% of edible fish and seafood species have declined by 90%, a drop that means the collapse of the fisheries. But the issue isn't just having seafood on our plates. Ocean species do a lot of things that you don't know about. They filter toxins from the water, for example. They protect shorelines. They reduce the risks of algae blooms like red tides. A large and increasing proportion of our population lives close to the coast. Thus, the loss of services such as flood control and waste detoxification can have disastrous consequences." The researchers analyzed data from 32 experiments on different marine environments. Then they analyzed the 1,000-year-old history of 12 coastal regions around the world, including San Francisco and Chesapeake Bay in the U.S., the Adriatic, Baltic, and North Seas in Europe. Next, they analyzed fishery data from 64 large marine ecosystems. And finally, they looked at the recovery of 48 protected ocean areas. Their bottom line, everything that lives in the ocean is important. The diversity of ocean life is the key to its survival. The areas of the ocean with the most different kinds of life are the healthiest. But the loss of species isn't gradual. It is happening fast and getting faster, the researchers say. Worm and his colleagues call for sustainable fisheries management, pollution control, habitat maintenance, and the creation of more ocean reserves. They say it's not too late. We could turn it around. But less than 1% of the global ocean is effectively protected right now. That's less than 1%. And if we do nothing, by 2048, no more fish. The Earth has a fever that could boost temperatures by 8 degrees Celsius, making parts of the surface completely uninhabitable and threatening billions of people's lives, according to a controversial climate scientist on Tuesday, James Lovelock, who angered climate scientists with his Gaia theory of a living planet, then alienated environmentalists by backing nuclear power, said a traumatized Earth might only be able to support less than a tenth of its current 6 billion people. "We're not all doomed," he said. "A lot of people are going to die, but I don't see the species dying out," he told a news conference. "A hot Earth could support much over 500 million people. Almost all of the systems that we've been looking at are now in positive feedback. And soon those effects are going to be larger than any of the effects of carbon dioxide emissions from industry and so on around the world." Scientists say global warming due to carbon emissions from burning fossil fuels for power and transport could boost average temperatures by up to 6 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, causing floods, famines, and increasingly violent storms. But they also say that tough action now to cut carbon emissions could stop atmospheric concentrations of CO2 hitting 450 parts per million, equivalent to a temperature rise of 2 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial levels, and save the planet. So all of these stories that I read seem to indicate that if we don't do something, we in fact are doomed. However, all of this appears to be, and I that's a careful word, appears to be reversible if we do something soon. Evidence of flu viruses frozen in Siberian lakes has prompted researchers to examine the possibility that global warming may release microbes locked in glaciers for decades or even centuries. Our hypothesis is that influenza can survive in ice over the winter, then reinfect birds as they come back in the spring. This according to Scott Rogers of Bowling Green State University in Ohio. He believes the frozen lake acts as a melting pot for flu viruses, allowing viruses from one year to mix with those from previous years. Rogers has spent decades searching the ice for microorganisms. He teamed up with Danny Shloem at Bar University Israel, David Glazinski at the Russian Academy of Sciences. And what they have decided is that, indeed, these influenza viruses can survive. And when you combine that finding with, of course, global warming, then you really have a very, very potentially serious, even deadly apocalyptic situation for the Earth. Well, when you look at all of these stories, again, I wonder what you, all of you out there, conclude. I know a lot of you sit out there and say things like, oh, this is just the sky is falling stuff, another sky is falling story. Well, the hits keep on coming, folks, and it seems to me if we don't do something, the sky, well, it really won't fall, of course. It'll simply be a situation where the Earth will not support our life. So the sky might as well fall. Metaphorically, it is, in fact, falling. Scientists have now levitated some small animals using sounds that are, well, uplifting. In the past, researchers at Northwestern Polytechnic University in China used ultrasound fields to successfully levitate globs of the heaviest solid and liquid iridium and mercury, respectively. The aim of their work is to learn how to manufacture everything from pharmaceuticals to alloys without the aid of containers. At times, compounds are simply too corrosive for any container to hold, or they react somehow or another with containers in other undesirable ways. So, it's interesting. They manage to hold this stuff in midair. They levitate it so that it doesn't have to be in a container that it would eat through or interact with in some ways. And now they have managed to, I suppose, for their own reasons, levitate things like ants, beetles, spiders, ladybugs, bees, tadpoles, and fish up to a little more than a third of an inch long in midair. When they levitated the fish and tadpole, the researchers added water to the ultrasound field every minute by using a syringe. So here you have, if you can picture it in your mind, you have this little fish levitating in midair, just hanging in midair, and the scientist taking a little syringe and adding water, which also levitated around the fish, I suppose, making it environmentally comfortable. Oh, what an age we live in, huh? The dinosaurs, along with the majority of... I'm thinking of that fish and a scientist injecting a little water around it. The dinosaurs, along with the majority of a lot of other animal species on Earth, went extinct about 65 million years ago. Sometimes scientists have said that the impact of a large meteorite in the Yucatan Peninsula in what today is Mexico caused the mass extinction, right? While others argue that there must have been additional meteorite impacts or other stresses around the same time. A new study provides some compelling evidence that one and only one impact caused the mass extinction, according to a University of Missouri Columbia researcher. So, one big kaboom is what they're now saying is what caused all the dinosaurs to die. Now, we're not as big nor as robust as the dinosaurs. So the next time you hear some scientist pleading for money to study near-Earth passing objects, and we've only got, I don't know, some small percentage of them documented. For God's sakes, urge your local legislators, your state and federal legislators, to give them the money. Because eventually something is going to come along, some big several mile in diameter type rock is going to come along, and they're not going to see it. It's going to come out of the sun, where it's going to be very hard to see. And, well, the dinosaurs, as I mentioned, they were big, they were robust, but they died very quickly. How do you think we would do? Next time some scientist has his hand out for money to look for something like that, for God's sakes, give it to him. I'm Art Bell. Hey. We're about to go to open lines, but let me read a couple of these. I appreciate all of the positive fast blasts that I get, certainly, but in a lot of ways, the negative ones are more interesting to read. Here we have College Station, Texas, and Heinrich, who says, "Hey, Art, with how much you and George saturate your show with apocalyptic content, it almost makes me think you want the world to end. Lighten up." Well, I'm not making these up. I'm just reading them. Now, want the world to end? I have a child on the way. Do I want the world to end? Hell no. Of course I don't want the world to end, but I do feel it might be important to call this sort of thing to people's attention. You know, small matters like the ocean having no more fish by 2048, that sort of thing. Global warming, viruses getting out of control, the kinds of things that would make life not comfortable for my child nor yours. So I think it's important that's what this show deals with, is edgy kind of stuff, if you want to really call it that, fine. And then there's this from Ray in Bellevue, Nebraska. I've never heard it rationalized quite this way, but he says, now, Art, if all the fish die, that's going to help with your so-called rising sea level, isn't it? This because the weight of all these fish is going to be gone and the sea level will lower. So we'll be better off. Also, there's absolutely no correlation between the weather in Florida or the East Coast and Philippine weather. You're off the deep end again. Well, Ray, actually, yes, there is. The world's weather is pretty much tied up together, and that the East Coast has had a light year for hurricanes and the Pacific a very heavy year for typhoons would indicate to me that the following year things will reverse and it will be the east coast of the U.S. that has a tough time with the big Category 5 plus hurricanes. That's just the way I feel, Ray. And then as far as all the fish dying, helping the sea level rise situation, I don't think, Ray, that all the fish dying is going to be a positive thing for us, even if it causes the sea level to rise not quite so high. Ray, I don't quite follow your rationalization, but if it makes you feel better, Ray, that's fine. By the way, the one very annoying thing here in the condo in Manila has been these little, we have these little tiny fruit flies, and they're simply impossible to get rid of, or I thought they were. And the building has tried all kinds of pest control companies, in fact, companies that do the biggest, best luxury hotels in the world, you know, that we've had them in. Nothing works. Well, the other day I happened to be in a Japanese restaurant, and I noticed they had this bug zapper. Now, it had two long bulbs in it, kind of ultraviolet, purplish-colored bulbs. And then behind, or just in front of the bulbs, there's this little grid, this electrical grid that is then protected in the front so nothing else can touch it. And every now and then you hear, zzz, zzz. And so I thought, aha, that's the solution. Went straight to Ace Hardware. Yes, we have Ace Hardware here. And bought one, brought it home. Put it up on top of the refrigerator, and voila, I haven't seen one of those little bugs in a week. Not in a week. And they were driving me nuts. Just these little teeny weeny things. And now I'll be sitting in the living room, and every now and then I'll hear, and I'll smile. Another bug bites the dust. And so that has cured the entire problem. All right, let's go to the lines and see what awaits. First time caller line would be Jamie in Calgary. You're on the air. Hi.
Hello, Art. How are you?
I'm quite well, sir.
That's good. I've been listening to you for a long time, and I'm really happy to talk to you. I was just kind of had some questions. I've been looking into this. Kind of hit me last month. I was just surfing the internet. I ended up coming across this, what you call a documentary on 9/11. And
okay.
Was about, well, it was called Loose Change. I don't know if you've heard of it, but
I'm not. Well, actually, I have heard the title somewhere, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, it was really compelling to me that I just never really looked at this before. But, I mean, there was some crazy things in there that just made me think. Mm. And
think about
know.
What?
Well,
what did you think about?
I just think that those towers were somebody, they had explosives in the building.
Really?
I mean, if you,
I could swear I saw those airplanes plow right into the building with my own eyes.
Well, the airplanes did plow into the building. Now, that's another story. I don't know exactly how those came to be. You know, they say it was the terrorists in the planes that did it. That's another issue. However, the planes going into the building, if you look at the actual World Trade Center towers, they're 110 stories. They were built like, they had 47 steel columns running down the middle part of the building, and the outside kind of held the floors together with the others, those parts of steel. But anyway, what the planes did was they came in. The government said that the jet fuel was melted the steel that held the floors up, so
that's
they
right.
collapsed in a pancake fashion, right?
That's right, yes.
So that's what they said, but if you actually take it, you know, you can't, they don't even account for the middle 47 steel columns that were in some parts of the building 4 inches thick steel. You know, you can't, steel doesn't, like jet fuel can't melt steel.
Oh, yes, it can.
It's not hot enough.
Oh, yes, it certainly is. Actually, you watched a documentary trying to prove a point that something else was at work here. I don't buy into it. I've never bought into it. We've had any number of experts on who have said that indeed the jet fuel did get hot enough to do the job, and I'm simply not one of those people who believes, and nor will I ever believe, unless I'm confronted with evidence that truly is compelling, and I have not yet, and believe me, I've looked into this and all the other documentaries. I'm sorry, I don't buy into it. Sometimes what appears to have happened is exactly what happened. Those were very large jetliners. They crashed into those buildings. There are some questions about Building 7. However, what happened there was a large geologic event. When those buildings came down, it is entirely possible that it weakened 7 enough so it came down as well. 7 is much more of a question in my mind than the two World Trade Center buildings. What happened to those, I think, is absolutely obvious. I think the temperatures were more than sufficient to do what was done. And once you have the pancaking, collapsing weight of the building down upon itself, well, down she comes. So, no, I don't buy it. I'm not one of those conspiratorial folks who thinks that our own government brought these buildings down, crashed an airplane into the Pentagon, and all the rest of it. I don't for one second think that. I think it's exactly what it appears to be. It was horrible. And I don't think we have to reach out for other explanations beyond the obvious. That doesn't mean that I'm blind to looking at possibilities. I'm not. I've looked very carefully. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi. No, make that wild card line. Russ.
Hi, Art. How you doing?
I'm okay.
Well, I know you're doing fine. Everybody asked you that. I heard a couple of weeks ago that you said you were trying to stop smoking.
Yes.
Okay. Well, when I had the flu, I realized that I went from two packs of cigarettes a day to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm laying in bed and I'm going, why am I not craving a cigarette? And I'm thinking there must be some type of a chemical reaction going on in my body. So I said to myself over and over, I want you to remember the chemical reaction that's going on in my body right now. Well, Art, it's been 8 years now, and I haven't smoked.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Now, I realized that.
I had the flu too, buddy. When I came over here, you can't take an international plane flight like this without coming. And I had a bad case of the flu and then several colds. And I still crave cigarettes, so I'm sorry it didn't work for me. I'm glad it worked for you.
Well, did you have the flu, though? I mean, I know you said you were sick.
Oh, I had the flu.
Did you have the full-blown flu?
Oh, yeah. I had a temperature for days and days. Yes, I had the flu.
Wow. Jesus.
So, it different things. We're all physiologically different people, and different things work for different people. And if that worked for you,
sure
God
did.
Bless you. I'm down to, for example, yesterday during the program, I only smoked 4 cigarettes. Normally, during the course of a 4-hour program, I would consume a pack of cigarettes. So, I'm doing very well, and actually that accounted for over half of the totality of the cigarettes I even smoked yesterday. So I smoked about 6 cigarettes yesterday, and normally smoke about 4. So I'm doing very well. I'm on the edge of running out of nicotine gum, and I don't know what will happen when I run out of gum. But I'm doing very well.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear. I was hoping that this would help you out.
This is, well, I'm not sure getting, no, I still smoked when I had the flu. How's that for awful, huh?
That's terrible. I don't see how you could even crave it, because I was totally shocked I wasn't craving at all.
I'm told that the nicotine habit is 3 or 4 times more potent than the heroin habit, which must make it one of the most addicting substances in the entire world. Remember that day when all the cigarette presidents, company presidents, sat there, CEOs, and said, one by one, no, it's not addictive. Not addictive.
Right.
Our cigarettes are not addictive.
Yeah.
Bull stuff.
Yeah.
I appreciate the call, sir. When I had the flu, I still wanted to smoke. Now, I did, during the flu and during colds, recognize the damage that cigarettes were doing. Because, of course, when you have the flu or a cold, you have additional lung problems. And so it exacerbates the problem anyway. So I'm well on my way. I'm doing pretty well. But I guess what I'm doing is trading the addiction of cigarette smoking for the addiction of chewing nicotine gum. And I'm getting concerned. They don't seem to sell nicotine gum here. I've tried, and I will continue trying to locate it, but I haven't found it yet. Wildcard Line 2, you're on the air. Hi.
Art?
Yes, Scott.
Hey,
in Michigan.
This is Scott. Calling from Merrill, Michigan.
Yes, sir.
In our local newspaper on Sunday here, we had an article in here about an emergency signal that actually came out of Denver, Colorado, from a secretive Air Force facility in Colorado Springs, that when they tested it out, it actually jammed over 5 million garage doors.
Huh. I've heard of a number of cases of satellites and other types of signals that have accidentally jammed or opened and then closed garage doors, that kind of thing. So I've heard of this before.
Today. And that's the first time I've ever heard about it, so I just wondered if you knew anything new or heard anything else that was going on.
No, it was an emergency signal, huh?
Yeah, it's supposed to be for the Homeland Security in case of a security threat.
I see.
I don't know what they're trying to do or anything like that.
So they weren't actually trying to open or close garage doors?
No. No, it just said when they tested out the signal that over 50 million garage door openers and hundreds of residents found that theirs suddenly had stopped working.
Stopped working. That's interesting. I'm not sure. I could see that a signal like that might open or close a garage door, But I'm not sure what could jam a garage door. That's intriguing. 50 million of them at that. I'll have to look into that. Fascinating. Those frequencies that open and close garage doors are generally in the VHF range, occasionally in the UHF range. For example, the garage door that we had at KNYE Radio, have at KNYE Radio, was in the VHF range. And the signal, of course, from KNYE was so strong that it completely swamped the garage door opener. And in order to get it to work properly, I had to exchange the unit for one that worked on a UHF frequency and then add a little outside antenna on top of that and put a lot of RF protection on it and finally got it to operate properly. But it was quite a job. Okay, let's move east of the Rockies to Jeff, I believe, in St. Louis, where probably it's cold. How are you doing, Jeff?
Definitely cold. Single digits. Good thing we got our power back a day ago.
Single digits?
That's what they're expecting.
Probably about 90 degrees here right now, Jeff, and about 90% humidity.
Oh, yes, definitely. Did you get my email? I sent you pictures and a video link of some of the damage.
No, I haven't received it yet. And speaking of damage, we have photographs now of on coasttocoastam.com of some of the typhoon damage over here. But yes, I've seen some of the photographs of some of the damage from the ice storm there. It was incredible.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Where's that global warming when you need it?
Well, actually, Jeff, this is part of global warming. Global warming is it's going to produce extreme weather in both directions.
I was trying to make a joke there.
I see.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome, and take care, Jeff. Yes, well, global warming, a lot of people say that, some in jest because they really understand what I'm saying. Others really are quite serious about what they're saying. It's cold, so global warming is baloney. Well, no, global warming will produce weather extremes of all sorts, and that includes cold as well. We're simply going to get increasingly... I hear a cat scratching on the door. We're going to get increasingly extreme weather of all varieties. On the international line, Matt in Ontario, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I just have a quick question. The first time I heard your program, I was about 16 years old, and it was your interview with a gentleman named Red Elk.
Oh, yes.
And I was just wondering, like, whatever happened to him and Mel's whole situation, if you've ever heard anything back or just...
I'm very tempted to be doing an update on Mel's Hole. I've been sort of wavering back and forth. I actually know how to get hold of the individuals involved, so
yeah,
stand by. I might do an update on it.
Okay, because I was about 16 years old, and it was the first time I just flicked on the radio.
How old are you now?
I'm 20. I missed school that whole day, too. I was scared to death.
You really? Mel's Hole scared you?
Yeah, and like I heard the program with the thing came out, and it took away guy's cancer. And
oh, yes. But I mean, it wasn't one of those things where Mel's Hole was going to get you. It was sort of a regional thing close, you know, to where it was happening.
Yeah, but it was so amazing, like, what was down there, like... I was born in June. I'm a Gemini, and all these things. June 5th is my birthday.
Mm-hmm. And all I'm June 17th, also a Gemini.
Mm-hmm. And life's weird. Like, I have a very weird dreams. Every night I have a dream. I'm always very lucid. I'm flying around. I'm doing very amazing things, and it just your program is really giving me insight, and I appreciate it.
Okay, buddy, take care, and who knows, maybe we will do a update on Mel's Hole. One of the things that has fascinated me all my life, along with time travel, which, by the way, at least in part, will be a subject coming up next with Sean Carroll, time travel, that is to say. The other thing that has fascinated me all my life are deep holes, any deep holes in the ground. There was a young lady named Kimberly who found one in Canada, and we're trying to do a follow-up on that. But if any of you know anything about very deep holes in the ground? Know of one, a secret one, perhaps near you somewhere? I want to know about it. Now, to get to me, you simply send me an email. I'm Art Bell at mindspring.com. That's A-R-T-B-E-L-L, lowercase, at mindspring, M-I-N-D-S-P-R-I-N-G.com. Love to hear from you on any subject. When we get back, Sean Carroll, and we'll be talking physics. Stay right where you are.